The following is a KOZE podcast broadcast. The Snake River Gazette with Keith Warnock.
This is the show that brings the rich history of the place we call home to life. Thanks to the Dream Team at Rick Woods Insurance, for nearly a century and a half, the Woods Insurance family has been doing business with one company, Farmers Insurance, Rick Woods Insurance on 21st Street, at rickwoodsinsurance.com, and on Facebook. Today we visit our departed icon, the Lewiston Speedway, its heyday, its tragedy, and its demise. We'll hear how the Great Depression affected us right here, and how the people of Idaho used their spirit and resourcefulness to survive. Plus, we'll discuss the lesser-known facts about our own vital contributions during World War I, both civilian and military. Two that fought the war, one that helped feed the world. One battalion from North Idaho joined the war effort years before the rest of the country. That's how we kick it off. Stallion Battalion, ho! Idaho's finest steeds marched into World War. In December 1914, the French Army paid the U.S. $17,000, or more than $400,000 today, for 200 horses culled from Grangeville, Kamiai, Nez Perce, and Cottonwood. The use of horses in World War I marked a transitional period in armed conflict, and Idaho horses went to war well before Idaho humans. The U.S. itself wasn't drawn into the war until 1917. At first, cavalry units were considered essential offensive elements of a military force, but over the course of the war, the animals were much more vulnerable on the battlefield due to modern machine gun and artillery fire, and the development of tanks ultimately replaced cavalry in shock raids. All that being said, horses still played a significant role throughout the war.
This portion of the show is being brought to you by saliva. Remember, when seeking to moisten the parched membranes within those hard-to-reach oral cavities, more people use saliva. Recommended by the American Mucus Association.
The Snake River Gazette with your host, Keith Warnock. The KOZE podcast broadcast.
World War I lasted from 1914 to 1918. All of the major combatants in the war began their efforts with cavalry forces. Germany stopped using them on the Western Front soon after the war began, but continued limited use on the Eastern Front well into the war. The Ottoman Empire used cavalry extensively during the war. On the Allied side, the United Kingdom used mounted infantry and cavalry attacks throughout the war, but the United States used cavalry for only a short time. Although not terribly successful on the Western Front, Allied cavalry did have some success in the Middle Eastern theater against a weaker and less technologically advanced enemy. Russia used cavalry forces on the Eastern Front, but with limited success. The military favored horses because they were better than mechanized vehicles at traveling through deep mud and over rough terrain. Horses were used for reconnaissance and for carrying messengers, as well as pulling artillery, ambulances, and supply wagons. The presence of horses often increased morale among the soldiers at the front, but the animals also contributed to disease and poor sanitation in camps caused by their manure and carcasses. By 1917, given the value of horses and the increasing difficulty of replacing them, some troops were told that the loss of a horse was more of a tactical concern than the loss of a human soldier. Ultimately, the blockade of Germany prevented their military from importing horses to replace those they'd lost, which contributed to Germany's defeat. By the end of the war, even the well-supplied U.S. Army was short of horses. Conditions were severe for horses at the front. Not only were they killed by artillery fire, but they also suffered from skin disorders and were injured by poison gas. Hundreds of thousands of horses died, and many more were treated at veterinary hospitals and sent back to the front. Lack of food for the horses was a major issue, and Germany lost many to starvation. Several memorials have been erected to commemorate the horses that died. World War I remains America's forgotten war. Even though more Americans gave their lives during that war than during the Korean War and the Vietnam War combined, and even though it profoundly shaped the rest of the American 20th century, Idaho provided over 19,000 troops to the U.S. Armed Forces during World War I. 1,782 died overseas. The National Guard 41st Division drew units and troops from Idaho. Draftees from Idaho provided manpower to the 91st Division, the Wild West Division. A month before the U.S. became officially involved in World War I, Grangeville Company, with 93 troops, and the 101 men from Lewiston's Company F were locked, loaded, and ready to roll.
Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back after these brief words from our sponsors.
The Snake River Gazette with Keith Warnock, the KOZE podcast broadcast.
Though the U.S. didn't declare war until 1917, the citizens of North Central Idaho were involved from the beginning of the war. In 1914, when we heard of the hardships suffered by Belgian civilians after the German invasion, we responded with donations of food and clothing. That same year, the Nez Perce High School Mothers Club collected 2 tons of basic necessities to be sent to Belgium. Area clubs and groups, even Julietta school kids, rounded up donations and sent them off to do what they could. Meanwhile, our perceptions about most anything German were negative. We discarded most items made in Germany, keeping only those goods made in the U.S. or allied countries. But as the war fever ran high, the anti-German sentiment wasn't confined to Germany and its citizens. Much of it was also heaped upon Americans, and indeed Idahoans, of German descent. Some simply expressed neutrality to the war in the hope for peace. And most all German Americans considered themselves as much loyal Americans as other U.S. citizens. And they made it clear that they were ready and willing to aid and fight for our country to the very end. Once we finally went to war, those back home were all expected to get involved as well. The Lewiston City Council even enacted an ordinance in June 1918, quote, compelling every able-bodied man from ages 16 to 60 to perform some useful service during the period of the war, or else go to jail. Then, on November 7, 1918, anticipating peace at any time, Lewiston was sent a false wire service report of the war's end, and a wild celebration erupted. When the real report came in 4 days later, we celebrated a bit more cautiously, just in case. But once it was confirmed, we sounded school bells and the fire alarm tower in the 5th Street Park, closed down our businesses, schools, and churches, and filled the streets in celebration. Now, it was time for our doughboys to head home. But what awaited them was a bit different from when they left. They had to prepare themselves for a United States that had entered the Prohibition era while they were gone. Perhaps not quite the nature of celebration they'd hoped for. The wet lobby had persisted as many Idahoans argued about inherent personal liberties, but the stern Idaho legislature nonetheless passed a state prohibition amendment with only a single vote being cast against it. By the early 30s, the war was on between federal agents and bootleggers. And as the government sensed the public's broad disdain for prohibition, it only made them ramp up their efforts to go after the moonshiners. Newspaper stories of the seizure of backcountry stills were prominent. And the feds didn't discriminate. Women bootleggers were routinely rounded up right alongside the men. By the time World War I ended, it had taken its toll of American lives. Not to mention lives abroad. Cities had been badly damaged, and food was scarce in many places. World War I had been great for our economy. Not only did we manufacture military weapons and uniforms to ship to our allies, we were lending money to allied governments, and U.S. farmers could barely produce food fast enough to supply the world's demand. But by the time the war ended, it had taken its toll on more than human lives. We faced other challenges. A worldwide flu pandemic cost 50 million lives across the globe, infinitely more than were lost in the war. The temperance movements had successfully established prohibition. Some staunchly agreed, but many resisted. And boy, was the country ready for a fresh start. But now, war-torn European countries couldn't repay their loans to us. Our factories were no longer in wartime production mode, and our farmers were no longer feeding the world. In 1919, the fallout from World War I had so crippled Idaho's main industries, mining, farming, and timber, that our state didn't get to enjoy much of the spirit of the Roaring Twenties that followed, like the rest of America. Prices for Idaho's famous potatoes plummeted from $1.51 a bushel to 31 cents, rising only gradually after that during the 20s, then crashing to an all-time low of just 10 cents a sack years later.
This is the Snake River Gazette with your host, Keith Warnock.
And thanks to the Dream Team at Rick Woods Insurance for serving up the Snake River Gazette each and every week. A four-generation family tradition, the Woods family and Farmers Insurance. Rick Woods Insurance on 21st Street, at rickwoodsinsurance.com, and on Facebook. The U.S. economy remained sluggish at best in 1920 and 21, but by 1922, things got a little better for a bit. More Americans moved to the cities. Post-war industry meant new modern gadgets. Radio, newspapers, and magazines ran enticing ads. And since many factory workers had money left over after they'd bought their basic essentials, they purchased new cars, radios, and appliances, and danced the Charleston. Those that didn't have money left over in their paychecks suddenly had a new option, the installment plan. Home mortgages sprung up like crazy, and the economy of the 20s was indeed roaring. And we were becoming a country of contrast. The nation's heroes shared the spotlight with gangsters like Al Capone, while the people on the farms that had fed the entire world were now finding it tough just to survive. Business tycoons made millions on the stock market. Conservative mothers of the day clashed with their daughters about showing too much leg with their shorter skirts and dresses and lopping off their locks in defiance of the traditional longer hair. On young men, out went the beards and in came the slick back hair. Suspenders were replaced by belts, drab colors and designs with crisper, brighter ones. The way the next generation viewed the world was different from their parents. The war had changed that, and it had changed the roles of young Americans. More people finished school, and soon women could vote. However, by 1929, news had surfaced of frightening economic times dead ahead. Americans halted major purchases like cars and homes, and production slowed to a crawl. As prices dropped, investors sold off their shares in haste. The value of stocks dropped, and after a massive sell-off on October 29th, we crashed. Many farmers faced foreclosure, but in Idaho, we figured out a way around that. At sheriff's auctions of foreclosed farms, as the auctioneers chanted, the farmers had quietly agreed to not bid against each other. So, a splendid team of horses sold for $1.50, a grain binder, $2, a hay mover, $1. The bids were paid, the items purchased, and promptly turned back over to the farmer who had been foreclosed. In Idaho, that's what's called being a good neighbor. On the other hand, there were the unemployed workers in six Idaho counties who deliberately set forest fires so that they could be hired to fight them. Governor Charles Benjamin Ross declared martial law in those counties and called in the National Guard to close the woods to the public. Idaho's timber industry was clobbered in 1932 when no one was building and there was zero demand for lumber. Mining tanked as well. Silver prices dropped from $1.39 an ounce in 1919 to just 24 cents in 1933, the lowest silver price in Idaho history.
This portion of the show is being brought to you by Phillips Milk of Amnesia. You'll never remember why you used it in the first place.
The Snake River Gazette with your host, Keith Warnock.
In 1933, a drought hit much of America, including Idaho, adding to the nation's woes. Rainfall in the state was 65% less than normal, and existing crop losses to potatoes, beans, beets, peas, and hay skyrocketed. Creeks and watering holes dried up, impacting the cattle, and applications for government help for drought relief poured in. Meanwhile, federal agencies like the Civilian Conservation Corps gave outdoor jobs to some 20,000 young workers, while the National Youth Administration provided part-time work to 5,000 high school and college students. Other agencies offered financial relief to 20,000 destitute families and 30,000 farmers. Some 4,000 Idaho laborers built infrastructure, roads, highways, reservoirs, schools, sewer systems, parks, airports, fairgrounds, and other projects. For America, and indeed Idaho, the Great Depression and World War I brought hardship, suffering, and pain. But it also ushered in a new and vibrant nation for those who endured and survived.
Recently, the most notable public questions that have concerned us all have had to do with industry and labor. And with respect to these, certain developments have taken place that I consider of great importance. I'm happy to report that after years of uncertainty, culminating in the collapse of the spring of 1933, we are bringing order out of the old chaos with a greater certainty of the employment of labor at a reasonable wage and of more business at a fair profit. These governmental and industrial developments hold promise of new achievements for the nation. Men may differ as to the particular form of governmental activity with respect to industry and business, but nearly all men are agreed that private enterprise in times such as these cannot be left without a system and without reasonable safeguards, lest it destroy not only itself, but also our processes of civilization. The underlying necessity for such activity is indeed as strong now as it was years ago.
An article in the Lewiston Tribune describes the climate in these parts during the Great Depression. With everyone's coffers gathering dust, Lewiston civic groups joined to petition Congress to use manual labor instead of machinery to build our highways. The slim pickings spread throughout every level of government in those lean days, too. So, for the good of the state and the country, several Idaho public officials even took voluntary pay cuts. But that wasn't the extent of the good we were doing right here every day. The people of Lewiston stocked community woodpiles for the winter. Enough orders came into area mills to keep us working. By 1941, the Lewis-Clark Valley and the rest of the country were focused on our impending involvement in the biggest world war of them all. And we prepared to make ready. That story in the next Gazette. Thanks again to the talented, dedicated authors and historians who preserve the rich history of the land we call home.
This is the Snake River Gazette with Keith Warnock.
The Snake River Gazette is brought to you every Sunday morning and via podcast by the Dream Team at Rick Woods Insurance on 21st Street. Find another place you can get nearly 140 years of combined service from one family with one company. I love them. Rick Woods Insurance on 21st Street at rickwoodsinsurance.com and on Facebook.
This portion of the show is being brought to you by the all-new product made especially for nervous people who need to chew on something but don't want to be kept awake at night. Ed's new caffeine-free fingernails.
For a quarter century, there was a consistent uproar many nights in North Lewiston. It was inescapable. Loud roars, amplified music, and sudden surges of hundreds of people cheering. You could hear it for miles. No, for the most part, the commotion wasn't emanating from North Lewiston's popular watering holes. From 1951 to 1975, the Lewiston Speedway was one awesome live entertainment venue. By 1971, it was part of a three-state racing federation. Many willing spectators, like myself, have been left with indelible memories of those days. To begin with, a group of local rival car enthusiasts tuned their cars to perfection on our highways, as well as on the dusty back roads between Lewiston, Kendrick, Julietta, and Orofino. Jim Anderson built a race car out of a 36 Ford Coupe in 1951. Then Jack Rohde, Tom Seals, and Paul Miles built hot rods. And these cats needed a real place to race. The original track, adjacent to the Lewiston Hill in northeast Lewiston, was used for the first year of racing, 1951. The place had originally been built for motorcycle racing, and on a hot LC Valley day, you could see the plumes of smoke hanging like clouds. The track's undeveloped infield was pretty rough too, and those modified old metal beasts were heavy and cramped, so the driver that hit the turn highest and hardest with horsepower cleared the others out in a hurry. Rohde won the track's first heat race, Anderson the track championship that year. The second year, 1952, the racers moved to the old roundup grounds. The following year, they moved back to the original track, and the year after that, 1954, that track was paved, and Lewiston Speedway was born. On Wednesday and Saturday nights for years during the race season, the roar of engines and the cheers of race fans filled the air. Young local driver Dixie Curl was a fan favorite in her Dairy Queen-sponsored VW, and she was good. As was Bill Scharnhorst, who had some great races in his 409. Nowadays, as we know, Bill and his wife, the former Dixie Curl, have raised a family and grown a very successful Lewiston business, Guardian Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning. Many drivers from the days of the Speedway are still local legends. The track attracted racers from other areas too, including Spokane's Tom Sneva, who later raced in the Indy 500. In 1963, Jim Anderson bought the Speedway for good. He also owned the Umatilla racetrack briefly in 1969 and 70. Then, 17 years after the first race, tragedy struck. As related in a previous episode of the Gazette, a special evening of racing had been planned for the 4th of July, 1968. During the night's second main event, Ken Steckman flew out of a turn, tangled with another driver, and flew into the infield past Jerry Ginsbach and his crew, straight into one of their gas cans. Immediately, Ginsbach, Vic Davidson, and Darrell Sattler were engulfed in flames. The rest of the evening was canceled, and all three men soon died. Those were the only fatalities ever at the Speedway, and the memories are still fresh today for many of the drivers that were there that night. After that, the racing tradition continued. Then came live music, and in 1975, one of the highest-grossing live rock acts of the day made its way to the Speedway. The band's lead singer and frontman, Jim Mangum, a self-described hillbilly, had been nicknamed Jim Dandy by his father when he was nine. He came from a town of about 300, Black Oak, Arkansas, after which the band was named. Who can forget their hit song, Jim Dandy, with Jim's raspy lead lines, accompanied by the great female backing? I was there that night and marveled at my chance to see this huge national act in Lewiston and at the Speedway. But by now, the glory days of the track were numbered. The noise became a problem as the surrounding area was being developed, and suddenly, the drivers found themselves racing with mufflers, which, if you're a race fan, you know is just not right. The track started losing money, the river levy plans had been drawn up, and soon, there'd be no room for racing. The handwriting was on the wall, and the ink was drying. But the last race in 1975 was truly fitting. Talk about going out in style. The track's lap record was broken 8 different times that night, with the top time turned in by none other than Tom Sneva. And those of us who were once spectators are left with our own special memories.
This is the Snake River Gazette with Keith Warnock.
That'll do it for this edition of the Snake River Gazette. And remember, when it comes to protecting yourself and your family, a 4-generation family tradition. Rick Woods Insurance on 21st Street, Lewiston, at rickwoodsinsurance.com and on Facebook. On the next Gazette, the way things were for us during World War II, our contributions to the war effort, and what we experienced here at home. Plus, how resources, industry, technology, and good old Idaho know-how shaped the Lewis-Clark Valley.
Download the podcast at KOZE.com and hear new episodes Sunday mornings at 10 on AM 950 KOZE.